Welcome to On the Money, where you can find out anything and everything to do with finance, business, and the economy. On the Money is broadcast live from the studios of Radio 2SER nationwide on the Community Radio Network. I'm Daniel Ellison, and coming up on the program...
So I think that what's happening in Australia is really ground zero in terms of what you're going to see in other markets around the world over time.
The world's biggest Tesla battery, based in South Australia, is getting an upgrade. But is this a long-term solution to the volatility in the energy market? Also on the program...
You should be focusing on economic growth projects to help economic growth, not to try to maintain this ideologically driven idea of a surplus.
Interest rates are at an all-time low in this country, so how will Australia start generating value for an economy desperate for stimulation? All this and more coming up on The Money. But first, while Australia is investing in new storage technologies, volatility in the energy market should remain high in the short term. So is there a way Aussies can not only protect themselves from high power bills, but to actually make a tidy profit in the wholesale energy markets? Well, Powerledger, an energy exchange based in WA, can see opportunities in this volatile market. I spoke to co-founder Dr. Gemma Green and begun by asking how this new model came about.
We saw an opportunity for the blockchain to allow create sophistication in the market such that there could be low-cost trading and settlement between small counterparties. So we formed the company 3.5 years ago with that product in mind, peer-to-peer trading, which also includes virtual power plants, trading within microgrids and across the grid. And then we also conceived trading of environmental commodities, so things like renewable energy certificates, and we've got a very large project in the US in that respect. And then the third product area is ownership of assets using the blockchain. So the blockchain is the asset register, and it can fractionalize assets down to small portions. So you could have like an electric vehicle charging station, and you might own $50 of it, and get and that might represent 0.5% of the value, and you'd get 0.5% of any income that asset might generate.
So Gemma, Australians have recently been given the opportunity through solar cells and batteries to become independent of the existing power grid. Do you see the future of Australian energy being less and less centralised, or will large stations such as Hornsdale in South Australia become more prevalent?
I don't think it's going to be one or the other in the energy system of tomorrow, but I think that the advantage of having energy close to where it's consumed is that there are less requirements to build out network, and by that I mean poles and wires, and so it can be a lower cost way of getting electricity to market. And if you've got the digital market mechanisms that allow smaller users to trade with each other and with the market itself, then you can have a very sophisticated market that's bilateral, both centralised and distributed, a hybrid market.
Powerledger has been engaged in large overseas projects in Europe and Japan, but has also recently entered the Australian energy market. Is that right?
We're very excited about the opportunities in the national electricity market and also on the West Coast. And we obviously launched our virtual power plant product approximately 2 weeks ago with Power Club in South Australia, because the prices are very volatile there. And so households that do have a battery can dispatch electricity into the peak periods and get an enhanced return on their battery and pay it back faster. And so I think virtual power plants that connect smaller users will encourage them to put batteries in, but importantly encourage them to put bigger batteries in because they can make money out of it. And so they are therefore more likely to stay connected to the grid, which is good for everyone.
So, Gemma, what has been the biggest challenge PowerLedger has faced entering the Australian market?
You've got to really understand what is fundamentally important to the utilities and the market and the client, you know, and the consumers in that market. And so it takes quite a lot of time to get, you know, to have a deep understanding of that and then to craft a project around it. But I think on the NEM, the Australian Electricity Market Commission has signalled its intention to create a bilateral market rather than a unilateral market. And what that means is, you know, for the better part of a century, it's been big power stations bringing electricity to consumers. But in the past 15 years, with the advent of rooftop solar and our batteries, a lot of generation is happening via the citizens and the businesses. I call it citizen utilities phenomena. But we don't have the sophistication in the market to make that happen. It's a bit like going to Coles and getting them to buy your homegrown tomatoes. And with the AEMC's announcements this week, last week and in the past few months, and also what the commissioners there have been saying, that they want to digitalise the market. They want to allow it to be bi-directional. They want to put the mechanisms in place such that you can have proper competition, a bona fide market, not just the big players, but also smaller participants that do add value, to be able to be remunerated for the value of the contribution that they make to the system. So I think that what's happening in Australia is really ground zero in terms of what you're going to see in other markets around the world over time.
Does that mean 2019 is a particularly good time for Australians to enter the market actively and actually begin trading?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is that the problems that we've got in the system, the volatility, the high prices, the unstable grid because of too much solar, that creates the preconditions for you know, more batteries to come online. And as you said, in South Australia today, they're upsizing the 100-megawatt battery to 150-megawatt. And that's an example of a centralised battery. And I think you'll see both those and distributed batteries, both at the household level but also community-scale batteries as well. So I think that you'll start to see many different iterations of batteries depending on what's happening in a particular situation.
Thanks, Gemma. So if someone wanted to jump in and invest today, what kind of investment are they looking at? And will your geographical location actually affect your potential profits?
Well, where you're located, like if you're in South Australia versus Victoria or New South Wales, the volatility is different in those places. So South Australia is the most volatile. And what that means is the price goes to $14.50 or very high more often there. And so your battery will be called upon more frequently in South Australia right now than in other places. So your battery will be used more and you'll be paid more. And so it represents a bigger economic opportunity at this point in time in South Australia. And there's also good battery subsidies there, up to $4,500 per battery, or even up to $6,000 if you're a pensioner. And so I think that can, if you look at the overall cost, it could be, you know, sitting around for a large solar system and a 10-kilowatt-hour battery, around $18,000 before the grant, and sitting around sort of, you know, $12,000 or $13,000 after the grant. So I think it's very exciting in the sense that you know, it's still obviously a large purchase, but you are able to get access to low interest loans as well. But then you've got the payback period on that, which used to be very long term, but now is coming down because of the ability for them to transact in wholesale market pricing.
Okay, and how might that work in practical terms?
Well, the prices are very volatile right now. So households with batteries would actually sell electricity to their energy company, and the energy company would purchase it from their customer instead of buying it in the wholesale market. And so it's an alternative source of electricity in the peak for the retailer. And using the blockchain, when you have more than one retailer in a particular location, it's possible to create cross-retailer trading and settlement on the blockchain. So one retailer could trade with another retailer's customers and pay them for the battery electricity that they use. I think that the volatile market is a short to medium range economic opportunity. As more batteries are deployed, the prices will come down, but then there'll be other things that change, and there could be new periods of volatility in the market caused by, say, electric vehicles. So in 2022, EVs will be the same price as a petrol car, and that's expected to be the point of liftoff for sales. And if you add consumer vehicles and also commercial vehicles to the grid, it could add about 40% demand to the electricity grid. And that could be very peaky at certain times of the day. And so the opportunities for the virtual power plant in those instances could emerge over time.
All right, thanks, Gemma. So you've recently engaged in a partnership with Powerbank in South Australia. What's the next step for PowerLedger in establishing your exchange?
Well, we've had the announcement a fortnight ago was a call for people to sign up to Power Club for the virtual power plant tariff. And they have had quite a lot of people sign up. So we're very excited to see the initial response. And then some of those have solar and batteries already, and some of them are purchasing them. And so I think the system going live will really kind of take shape at the beginning of next year, and that's where we'll start to see how much trading is going on and how much money the households are making from participating in the virtual power plant.
Dr. Gemma Green, co-founder and chair of PowerLedger, speaking there.
I know what you're trying to say, girl. You're trying to say, oh, yeah, it's business time. It's business time. It's business. It's business time.
I know what you're trying to say. You're trying to say it's time for business. It's business time.
Ooh, it's business. It's business time.
Yeah.
Then went in the bathroom, brushing our teeth. That's all part of the foreplay. I love foreplay. A shake, a shake. Then you sort out the recycling. That isn't part of the foreplay process, but it is still very important. Next thing you know, we're in the bedroom. You're wearing that baggy old ugly t-shirt you got from your work several years ago. You know the one, baby, with the curry sting. I remove my clothes very, very clumsily, tripping sensuously over my pants. Now I'm naked, except for my socks. And you know when I'm down to just my socks, what time it is.
It's business. It's business time.
You know when I'm down to my socks, it's time for business. That's why they call business.
Make a love for two. Make a love for 2 minutes. When it's with me, girl, you only need 2 minutes. Because I'm so intense. You whisper something sexy like, is that it? I know what you're trying to say, girl. You're trying to say, oh yeah, that's it. And you tell me you want some more. Well, I'm not surprised. But I'm quite sleepy.
It's business. It's business time.
Business hours are over, baby.
It's business. It's business time.
In a recent media release, the RBA mentioned a list of reasons to back up their decision to keep interest rates low. Among some of those reasons are the trade war between China and the US add the recent droughts in New South Wales, which in turn have increased food prices. However, the real question is what strategy Australia should take to activate our long-lasting sluggish economy. Luis Ribeira finds out.
During the global financial crisis, the Reserve Bank decided to drop the interest rates to save our economy at 4.25%. Today, that number has changed to 0.75%. You might ask, why is the interest rate so low at this moment? I spoke to Dr. Scott Kelly, Research Director at UTS Institute for Sustainable Futures, about the effects of this recent interest cut.
Anyone who has borrowed money will be a winner because the cost of borrowing has declined. So if you have a mortgage, you are a winner. If you have debt, you are a winner because when you borrow money, you pay for the privilege of doing that, and that is paid through the cost of interest. When interest rates go down, then you are a winner. The people who are losers in this arrangement are people who don't have borrowing costs, who haven't borrowed money. So also the losers would be retirees, so people with substantial savings who have invested money in current account or a savings account with low interest rates. However, this is probably a very small part of the population because most retired people have either invested in assets like house prices, which have seen significant increases in Australia over the last decade, or they've invested in a superannuation fund. And because of the strongly increasing equity prices in the share market, which have been performing above average over the last several years, the effect of that has been actually an increase in retirement savings. If that money has been invested wisely through superannuation funds and in shares. If a retiree invests money in a savings account, then they probably wouldn't have done as well.
The constant drop of interest rates could become a trap because it's not sustainable and it's not helping our economy. It incentivates people to borrow more because they take advantage of low interest rates, and this leads people to have less savings and build more debt.
What we're facing now in Australia is record levels of debt. And so I think, largely the population has reached almost the limits of their borrowing capacity. And we're in this low interest rate trap where, central banks are loath to increase interest rates anymore because that will lead to the population not being able to repay their mortgage repayments. So even small increases in interest rates will lead to a significant increase in the amount that people with mortgages will have to repay, and that will have a negative effect on the economy. So central bankers are really nervous about increasing interest rates because of that reason.
The Reserve Bank may need to reduce interest rates to a negative percentage, and this is not a positive position.
So what happens generally when money gets invested is you have excess financial reserves and you invest that in a bank, and for the privilege of investing that money, you would get paid an interest on those savings.
As we are all aware, one of Australia's main exports is coal. However, sustainable energy could be the answer to boost the economy.
My latest research is working with the financial sector in Australia, and there's a huge appetite across all financial institutions to better understand the risks posed by climate change, to better understand how they can manage those risks, but also the opportunities of where they can see the growth in terms of moving to a more sustainable economy.
In a globalised economy, Australia is connected to major economic players around the world, and their negative effects will always affect our economy. I asked Macquarie University Dr. Sung Yung Kim from the Department of International Relations how international events can affect our economy.
The trade tensions and the slowing down of growth is undoubtedly fueling the RBA's decisions amongst many other decisions. Some of the decisions that the RBA is dealing with is, of course, record high house prices still, enormous debt that's been carried by Australians. I think Australia has now, the second highest largest per capita debt in the world, just behind Switzerland. And that has a lot to do with, of course, the enormously high mortgages that Australians are carrying. So I just think that the US-China trade war is one factor, but it's certainly not the only factor in the RBA's cash rate decisions. Look, there's no doubt that that the Reserve Bank is being strongly influenced by external factors such as the US-China trade war. But this is something that that all governments
especially those governments in the developed countries, are all trying to deal with. You know, all countries in the developed world are struggling with a low cash rate, and Australia is no different in that respect.
An institution that has more power to change our economy is our federal government.
The RBA government has been saying for a very long time that that the federal government needs to do much more on macroeconomic policy. I mean, like, one of the things that we should be thinking about is how to drive new export opportunities. You know, in this country, one of the big things we should be focusing on of course, is you know, things like renewable energy technologies and establishing Australia's place as a hydrogen exporting country. I mean, that would drive enormous levels of economic growth for this country.
Let's face it, the Reserve Bank has limited power to improve our economy.
Look, just to quote something that the former Prime Minister Paul Keating recently said, you know, economic austerity is just not working. I mean, if that's the federal government's main economic tool to try to somehow maintain this idea of a surplus, which hasn't actually been shown to be all that useful right now, and if anything, it's probably the thing that it shouldn't be doing. It should be focusing on economic growth projects to help economic growth, not to try to maintain this ideologically driven idea of a surplus. And so what the country needs to do is focus on things that are job-creating, that will help export opportunities, and this is what should be on the government's agenda right now.
Dr. Sung-Yang Kim from Macquarie University's Department of International Relations, ending that report from Luis Ribera.
From Hobart to Alice Springs, from Woodend to Taree, this is On the Money, making sense out of all those dollars.
You're listening to On the Money around Australia on the Community Radio Network. I'm Daniel Ellison. This past week, university campuses in Hong Kong have become flashpoints for protests against the China-backed government and police. Currently, an estimated 300 student protesters are barricaded inside Polytechnic University in Hong Kong, with police cutting off access to the campus in an attempt to force the protesters to surrender. Toby Hennings has the story.
This is the sound of two student protesters trying to escape the security blockade around Polytechnic University. This is just the latest incarnation of the conflict between demonstrators and police after months of unrest, with the police now barricading protesters into the Polytechnic campus. Timothy O'Leary, the head of the School of Humanities and Languages at UNSW, explains the rationale behind this.
The police, basically what they want to do is to be able to arrest all of those protesters. So they set up this cordon. They don't allow other protesters to approach from the outside, and they don't allow the protesters from the inside to leave until they're ready and able to arrest them all. The kind of siege situation is something which is quite a very recent development in these protests in Hong Kong, because the early months were characterized by the expression from the Bruce Lee character film, to be water, where the concept was much more fluid, agile, almost like guerrilla tactic. But this phenomenon of students actually barricading themselves inside university campuses is quite a new development. And I think what you see happening at Polytechnic at the moment, the sort of drawback of that strategically from the point of view of the protesters, is that they are literally stuck now inside the campus and they can't get out without going through the police. And of course, that's when the police will arrest them.
Police have taken to firing rubber bullets and tear gas canisters, while protesters have armed themselves with petrol bombs, javelins, and bows and arrows. Ben Bland, research fellow at the Lowy Institute in Sydney and the author of Generation HK, Seeking Identity in China's Shadow, explains the dangers of this standoff.
The concern is that as this drags on, the potential is for some really bad final showdown, because I think the people who are barricaded in there, these now think that, you know, they're going to be arrested if they surrender, and if they stay, there's a chance somehow they might get away, so they're going to carry on fighting. Hong Kongers want to maintain their democratic freedoms. They want to have full elections for their own leaders and their city council, and they want to maintain their autonomy from the rest of China, which is governed directly by the Communist Party. And obviously, Beijing, the Chinese Communist Party, doesn't want to give them those things. In fact, they want increasingly to incorporate Hong Kong into the mainland, and the hardline approach of Xi Jinping is not to give an inch.
This blockade comes at a critical time, with the Hong Kong District Council elections scheduled to be held next Sunday. Timothy O'Leary explains the significance of this.
So if the violence continues at the level of which it is at the moment, this would give the government a pretext to cancel those elections, at least suspend them for the moment. The onus is very much on the government now to make a move, to show that they're willing to, you know, to basically to discuss some of the underlying issues with the protesters, and not only with the protesters, but with a large part of the population who would in some way support the protesters.
Concerns that the Chinese government could send in its military forces were heightened as troops were deployed this past weekend to clear blockades. However, Ben Bland doesn't think this is likely.
I think in the end, that is the nuclear option, because once you've done that, it's very hard to maintain the fiction that Hong Kong is semi-autonomous and thereby deserves the privileged trade access it gets to Australia, to the US, to the European Union.
For someone like Timothy O'Leary, who spent 17 years living and working in Hong Kong, the past few months of unrest and violence have been dispiriting and shocking.
Primarily, it is really shocking to see, not just because I guess anyone might be shocked at looking at the images, but shocking because, having had the experience of the people in Hong Kong, it is quite remarkable to see that so quickly so many people in Hong Kong have turned to this kind of violent action, which would have been unimaginable during the last major protest movement in 2014. On the other side of that divide, it's extremely shocking to see the Hong Kong police acting in the way they've been acting, because certainly before 2014, one would never have imagined that Hong Kong police force would behave in that way towards Hong Kong people. So on both sides, it's quite shocking to see it, to see what's happened to the city so quickly and so unexpectedly. I think there's a growing sense of a dwindling possibility that there would be a positive or a peaceful outcome to it.
Timothy O'Leary, head of the School of Humanities and Languages at the University of New South Wales, ending that report by Toby Hennings. You're listening to On the Money around Australia on the Community Radio Network. I'm Daniel Ellison. That's all we have time for on the Money this week. Tune in again next week to find out everything you need to know about finance, business, and the economy. Thanks very much to producers Toby Henning and Luis Ribera, and of course our executive producer, Roderick Chambers. On the Money is produced in the studios of Radio 2SER for the Community Radio Network and with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can find all our shows and stories at 2ser.com/onthemoney. You can also subscribe to our podcast. New episodes are coming out every week. To follow us on Twitter, look for On The Money 2SER, and you can also find us on Facebook and Instagram for further updates. I'm Daniel Ellison. We'll be back again next week to give you the inside running on all things financial. Thanks for your company.